Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How you doing? We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. It is Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. We are going to be talking about mascots in honor of JoJo, the new lovable one-eyed furry mascot for the Jewel Osco Corporation. And then we're going to talk about mascots from products that we love that are very memorable. We'll get into that as well. And we'll have another round of pop-up video. Skip Skipley will be here. And the whole gang will play. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And right now, though, we want to welcome back to the show our good friend Dan Feinberg. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. He is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we welcome Dan to the show. Hey, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. All right. Let's, first of all, Fargo ended since we last spoke, and I would like to know what you thought of, because the last time we talked, it was the penultimate. We were talking about the penultimate episode, the first one directed by Keith Gordon, and then now the finale has aired, also directed by Keith Gordon. How did you feel that it ended?
I thought it was another beautifully directed episode by Keith Gordon. There were a lot of just really wonderful pieces of imagery, and it was also very, very different from the previous episode. I had interviewed him, and I hadn't given it necessarily any thought until then, but he talked about how the penultimate episode is a very intimate episode, but the finale, there are a lot more of the sort of exterior shots, the kind of frontier prairiness of it was brought out a little bit more, and I thought that was a nice contrast. I thought that there were lots of kind of shocking beats, lots of emotional beats, and, you know, without spoiling anything, an ambiguous ending. And, you know, an ending that's open to conversation, and I thought it was probably the right way for it to end. I think it was also nicely in communication with the final season of The Leftovers, which the entire season felt like it was kind of going back and forth with, even though, as of a couple weeks ago, Noah Hawley hadn't watched The Leftovers finale yet, but yeah, I thought it was very satisfying. I thought the penultimate episode was a little bit more emotionally effective, but I liked the finale a lot. How about you?
I thought it was great. I really did, and I thought the whole season was just terrific, and it ended on a really strong note. Yeah, and you know what you were talking about, that the sequence, I don't want to give anything away, but there's a sequence that takes place on a highway between two vehicles and a state trooper showing up. That whole sequence leading up to the end of that with the dissolves that he uses was really beautiful and shocking as well, but just really beautifully handled. I also thought that the entire sequence in the warehouse of the factory with the elevators was really awesomely suspenseful and really beautifully directed. And I loved the ending. I really did. And I mean, I knew at one point, you know, when he held a couple of shots pretty long, I was like, oh, it's going to end any second now.
Yeah.
And it did. And it was beautiful. And you can, you know, that's the thing about it. You know, like one of the things about, you know, the movie and how they echo, you know, the themes and the tone of the movie is that it's the way that Marge looked at life. You know, it's either, you know, some people choose to look at it as, you know, glass half empty. Some people look at it as glass half full. And I thought he brought that theme back in that final moment. Really beautifully. And I love the ambiguity of it. I really thought it was terrific.
I think that the movie gives you more reason to kind of believe Marge's worldview, whereas I don't know necessarily if I believe Gloria Bergel's worldview. And I think that has a lot to do with the kind of the dark backdrop of the story and the cynical malevolence of V.M. Varga, and how he related to basically the economic wood chipper that the common man is being thrust into.
Right.
A different Fargo analogy. And when I interviewed Noah Hawley about the finale, I pointed out that the 5-year time jump, minor spoiler but not huge, brings the story to the present day. And his answer was, well, I didn't think about that. I just wrote 5 years later.
Yeah.
But to me, taking the story to the present day puts me in my own frequently dark and vaguely depressed about the world perspective.
Yeah.
It makes it harder for me to look at the way things go and go, there's reason for optimism. But I love the idea that people can still feel optimism coming out of it, because that is obviously what the story wants you to feel. I just know that I'm having a harder time perhaps feeling that optimism myself.
Right. So what it's you interviewed Noah Hawley a couple of times, correct?
Yeah, I interviewed him at the beginning of the season, interviewed him at the end of the season, and also talked to him at the ATX Fest in Austin. So several conversations with Noah this season.
And, of course, you talked with Carrie Coon. And you talked about her very special TV spring, and she really has knocked it out of the park. I'm playing a little catch up now on Leftovers, and Dan, we'll talk about that in a little bit. You also wrote an article about this being the perfect time to play catch up. So I'm catching up. I'm still behind about four episodes on the Leftovers for this season, but it's pretty amazing, and she's fantastic on it. What was it like talking with her?
Oh, she's just utterly charming. I mean, she is a Midwestern woman, and it's impressive how much of Gloria I think there is in her, or maybe how much of her she put into Gloria, I guess. She's very chipper, she's very upbeat, she's very appreciative of having this moment and kind of how she came to it and the luck that comes from it, getting stuff like this offered to you, but also, obviously the skill of being fantastic. And she just had a great perspective on all of the emotional twists of both shows, the sort of the different challenges of working in the high octane emotional realm of Leftovers versus the sort of more arch tone of Fargo and finding emotion in that. She was just utterly charming. It was a pleasure to chat with her. But, all spring, I was doing interviews for both Better Call Saul and Fargo on a weekly basis, just because. And talking to smart people about smart shows is one of the best things I do. And those are two shows in which the creative teams are incredibly smart and incredibly thoughtful about what they do, but also in which the actors are incredibly thoughtful about what they do. And that's not the case with every show, but it's more often than not the case with the very, very good shows.
Yeah. Well, it was a terrific season. And is there any word on season four?
The word is that Noah Hawley says that if/when he has an idea for another season, he'll take it to FX, and FX will obviously say, sure, make your next season. And so as of now, he doesn't have an idea yet, so he says. And as of now, he's working on Legion Season 2. So the fact that he has this other show that he has a similar degree of control and personal investment in means that there's less urgency for him to turn around another season if he doesn't feel like he has it. So I expect that down the road we will have another season, but if he's in the early phases of writing the second season of Legion now, by the time Legion gets done with production, it could be another long stretch before we see another season of Fargo. So enjoy what you got and treasure it. And I'm betting it'll come back around again, but I wouldn't expect, honestly, I would expect maybe spring of 2019, that possibly. That's a long time off.
Okay. All right. Well, I am impatiently waiting. So,
I see.
Hey, by the way, you wrote a piece about, and this isn't TV related, but you wrote about Baby Driver.
I did indeed, which I know I liked less than you did.
Yeah. So. I don't think anybody liked it as much as I did. I don't even think Edgar Wright likes it as much as I do. But what were your reservations about it?
I just think that it's the thing that has perplexed me from a lot of the reviews, and you're not the only person who loves it, is the kind of, the idea that it's this beginning to end thrill ride. And to me, the first 20 minutes are magnificent. They're bracing action filmmaking, but also beautiful, comedic, musical filmmaking. It's fantastic. But to me, the movie peaks so totally in those first 20 minutes. And the last 15 to 20 minutes, and this is, for me, an Edgar Wright problem, really, in all of his movies, it doesn't know where it wants to go. And so I had a lot of thoughts towards the end that I don't know that you're supposed to have if you're fully invested. And so, to me, it's very much a Forrest Gump as a heist driver movie. And with all of the sort of inherent problems of an innocent in a world of darkness who gets to come out scot-free because he's sort of an innocent and you're not supposed to question it too much. And, you know, Forrest Gump, when it came out, people didn't question it. And then gradually and increasingly and, you know, now completely people question it. I wonder if down the road people are going to be a little less enamored than when the adrenaline was roaring. But I don't know. I mean, you're not the only person who loves it as much as you do. So,
yeah, no, I was absolutely blown away by it. But again, with the exception of Scott Pilgrim, I love all of his movies.
Now, why do you not love Scott Pilgrim?
And I've only seen it the one time, and I had a very negative reaction to it. I should go back and watch it again, considering how much I like Edgar Wright. But the movie just kind of drove me nuts. I didn't like the visual style of it. I didn't care about the characters. A lot of it seemed forced. To be fair, I'm not familiar with the source material. I was not. But it just really rubbed me the wrong way.
It's a very good representation of the source material. Now, the fact that the source material could also have rubbed you the wrong way is entirely possible, because it's very self-conscious. The graphic novel is also extraordinarily self-conscious, and so it's up its own butt, but it's up its own butt, I think, in ways that are very, very inspired. And also, that's another one where I'm not sure about the ending, which deviated from the source material.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, we're going to get back to talking TV with Dan Feinberg. We'll take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then afterwards we'll jump into more TV talk, including the Television Critics Association announced their 2017 TCA Award nominees. And we will talk about that as well right after we take this break for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I'm your overnight dude here till 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for Talk and Text. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. Esmeralda and I will play another edition of pop-up video. Coming up a little bit later on, we're going to talk about some of the most classic mascots that have ever lived. Or not lived, that were created. but right now we're talking TV with Dan Feinberg. Every couple of weeks, Dan joins us. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan.
Howdy.
Hi. So, part eight of Twin Peaks. I've watched it twice. I plan on watching it again, considering that there is no Twin Peaks this weekend, just so I can let it ruminate a little more. I thought I was stunned by episode three. this left me speechless. What are your thoughts on episode eight?
My thoughts are that I think they probably should have just aired episode eight over again on Sunday and just not mention to anyone that it was a repeat, and seeing how many people were like, whoa, it was almost exactly the same, but there were just these tiny little differences. It's just what Lynch wanted. I think people would have done very screwy things. I think rewatching it on Sunday would be a great idea. It's pretty crazy. It's just gorgeous. That episode is just so beautiful, and whether it's deeply profound or just ridiculously stunning visual storytelling without necessarily a story, I'm not sure, but I don't know. But boy, it's gorgeous.
I watched it the Monday morning after my shift. So I did not watch it the Sunday, and I did not watch it while it was airing. And right around 9 o'clock our time, Central Time, right around 9:03, my news feed blew up. With people just saying, what was the, every other post on my news feed on social media was about how insane this episode of Twin Peaks was. So I had been, thinking about it, like I did the show, I got home and I watched it at 6 o'clock in the morning on Monday. And with all of this knowledge that it was insane and all of the people on my news feed were just like astounded at its insanity, and I still was like blown away by it in terms of like just complete insanity. And you know, and then like I just it's like 15 minutes in, there's an uninterrupted 6-minute performance by Nine Inch Nails, which which of course the song though can be, you know, like interpreted as about kind maybe about Laura Palmer and the fact that, you know, Lynch directed a couple of Nine Inch Nails videos that look a lot like the imagery from this season of Twin Peaks. It all kind of makes some sort of sense, but I just couldn't believe it was on television. I just sat there and I said, this is primetime television right now, and this is on.
Yeah, I think even more than that third episode, this is one of those things where you just sit back and you go, okay, wow, Showtime just really did let David Lynch do whatever the heck he wanted.
Exactly.
And just imagining the expressions on their faces when he turned in this cut. And they just went, okay, well, I guess this is what we signed on for.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, look, if you're going to get David Lynch, you better let him do his thing. And I don't think anyone anywhere is saying that this has been an adulterated version of David Lynch. So bless is all I can say to that.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, this was crazy. Every bit of the imagery is hypnotic. The, you know, all of the World War II nuclear test, all of that stuff, you know, it's shocking to watch, and it's powerful as sort of a basic primal image. And I think there's a lot of that in what he was doing in this episode, was things that freak you out in your internal organs, you know, in the back part of your brain, you know, in your lizard brain, as opposed to much more blatant stuff. And,
yeah.
Hard not to admire on that level.
Yeah, and beautiful. I mean, just like beautifully shot in black and white. Most of the episode is in black and white. And very, very creepy. I mean, like skin-crawlingly creepy and really scary. The final act of it is just, I think, terrifying. And some of the imagery, as you mentioned, the imagery involving a young teenage girl who is sleeping on her bed and something comes into her room.
Yeah.
And I mean, come on. I mean, that's an image that I'm probably never going to forget, you know? I mean, geez.
I think there's got to be some reminder that Lynch is, you know, he's a psychological horror director, but he's very much a horror director somewhere in his skill set, whether that's what he is primarily, you know. Eraserhead is nightmare fodder.
Yeah.
Blue Velvet is nightmare fodder. You know, Fire Walk With Me, Killer Bob, all of this, he's a horror director of a very particular psychological type, and this was him working at full power.
Yeah, I agree. I was stunned by it, and I can't wait for the next episode. All right, let's go completely opposite end of the spectrum here and talk about The Gong Show. Now, this insane fad of bringing back 70s game shows in primetime has, I mean, it's a huge success, correct?
It certainly does well for ABC because none of it costs any money at all. And, you know, apparently stars really are willing to take this as a promotional platform, either to be on the guest panels or, I mean, my God, this is 2017 and Jamie Foxx, Mike Myers, who else? Alec Baldwin. These people are game show hosts now?
Yeah.
How is this happening?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it obviously does well for them, and they obviously keep trying things. And Gong Show did reasonably well, and I never need to see Tommy Maitland again.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about it. That's what drove me nuts, Dan. I mean, I grew up on The Gong Show. I was like 13, 12 years old when that show was at the height of its popularity, 13, 14 years old. So I loved it. I watched it every day. And so the format I like, and I think there are enough crazy acts in the world, you know, I mean, essentially The Gong Show it has inspired so many other shows. I mean, America's Got Talent is The Gong Show. I mean, it's essentially The Gong Show. It's that they press a big X instead of hitting a gong. But it's the same structure. I thought they had, you know, the panel I thought was great on the opening episode. I thought some of the acts were fun. I could not stand Mike Myers. He made me nuts on it. And that's going to be a massive hurdle for me going on.
I think it's probably going to prevent me from watching. I don't get it as a gimmick. I don't see what purpose they think it serves to have Mike Myers encased in latex doing a not fun funny version of 15 other Mike Myers characters we've seen him do in the past. I mean, for heaven's sakes, get the Scottish father from How I Married an Axe Murderer to be the host of the show. I think 98% of viewers would be much happier if he talked about the size of contestants' heads and compared them to Sputnik.
Right.
Just who wouldn't watch that?
Right.
Whereas who's Tommy Maitland? He's nothing. It's not a good character.
No.
So why bother?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'll watch it again, you know, just out of curiosity. But man, I this Tommy Maitland thing, just like you, it drove me nuts. I was like, I can't get past this fan. I'm not the biggest Mike Myers fan in the world either, so that doesn't help. But yeah, so those primetime game shows are gonna continue, and I know that Candy Crush is actually now gonna be a game show with Mario Lopez.
Yeah. For future reference, next time I come on, I will not have anything to say about Candy Crush. That one is not going to be on my radar. There have to be limits, and Mario Lopez hosted versions of popular apps. And I mean, you know, an app that I do have on my phone and a game that I have surely wasted hours playing, but no, that is not something that I need in this world and perish the thought that the world needs it.
Yeah, well, don't worry about it. I'm not going to bring it up again, Dan, because I'm not going to watch it. I mean, I'll see.
I wasn't sure if you were going to get sucked in. I mean, there were a lot of ads for it during Big Brother.
Well,
so they might hook you that way.
No, but that's the only reason that I even know about it is because I watch Big Brother. And did you watch last night's Big Brother?
I did indeed. I figured that was where you were going in the other end of the scale from Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
From Twin Peaks to Big Brother. So, yes, did watch this.
See, we got interrupted. We last night we had some insane weather here in the Chicago area. And so about 35 minutes of the show was interrupted for storm coverage locally. And it happened right during the let's balance on the trapeze and get an apple contest. So I missed the end of that, and then when it came back on, the kid—I don't want to give anything away—but the biochemist from Woodridge, Illinois, Cameron, trying to sweet talk the ladies by stripping, by doing a little striptease. So I missed everything from that to the little striptease, and then I saw how it ended. So I missed a chunk of it.
You did not miss much of anything. You did miss there was a good interaction with the sort of scary Jim Caviezel-y military guy.
And the
pint sized Asian woman who pretended to be 18 but's really 28. There was a good interaction with them at the end of the challenge. Otherwise, you didn't miss anything.
Okay.
But it seems like a very big brotherly cast. I mean, for heaven's sakes, there's a young woman who's a dancer and a Ghostbuster.
Right. Absolutely. And they brought your boy back. They brought Paul back, maybe to right his idiocy from last season. I don't know. But I liked him. He was the guy I was rooting for last year. So is there any standouts for you in this cast? I know it's only the first episode.
I liked the dancer who's also a Ghostbuster. I thought that was a good combination. I was very disappointed, frankly, by the rodeo clown the rodeo clown was not, in fact, Chip Baskets, because if you can have a rodeo clown, it should be Chip Baskets.
Right.
Let's see. Who did I – I don't know. The stay-at-home lobster from Boston.
Yeah.
I don't understand what he is, but I kind of like, because I don't understand if he's ever really watched the game before. He had no clue who Pauly was.
Right.
He doesn't seem to understand basic strategy of the game, but he has a collection of three-piece suits, and I think he's going to try to have someone whack during the season, I want to see that.
I got to tell you, Dan, that's the guy I was leaning towards, too. I was just like, who is this guy? Why did he audition for this show? I just don't get it.
He's like Evil Dick if Evil Dick actually were a mobster who probably has had people killed before, or you know, something to that effect. Maybe not killed. Maybe he just had like storefront burnt down or something.
Right.
I don't know how deep into the game he is, but he's weird enough and out of place enough on the show that I would like to see him do interesting things. Also, I would like to see several of the men go to war over the jiggly Instagram model.
Yeah.
Because they're all into her for perfectly obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And I get the feeling that at some point things may come to blows, and I would like to watch that happen.
Yeah, so, I agree. Well, I think it's going to be I think it's going to be a fun season. And I waste three nights a week every summer on this show, and I make no apologies about it because I really enjoy it. So, all right, hang on, Dan. Okay.
Sure.
All right, there you go. Dan Feinberg is here. And last night, of course, Big Brother did premiere. And yes, I do. I'm a loser. I watch all three nights every summer, and I have for many years. And it's, you know, it's my one, like, sort of guilty, ridiculous reality show pleasure. So, well, no, I have more than that, but Big Brother's the big one. All right, we got to take a break. Dan Feinberg is with us, and we're going to talk more TV right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. We are going to talk about mascots, and we are going to play some pop-up video. That's all coming up on the show, so please stick around. Dan Feinberg joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. He's from The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and we're talking TV. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
Before we jump into the TCA Award nominees, which I'm very excited to talk to you about, I binged GLOW over the last weekend. And
this does not surprise me. How many steps did you how many sittings did you watch it on?
Two. Started on a Friday, had a busy Saturday, ended on a Sunday. I really liked it a lot. I thought it was very, very good, and it was actually more than I had expected it to be. I thought the ensemble was really good. I thought Alison Brie and particularly Marc Maron were terrific on it. I thought the whole cast was, but I was particularly surprised by the relationship between Alison Brie's character and Marc Maron's character, and I really, really liked it. Particularly one episode, I don't want to give anything away, but one episode he escorts her someplace that she has to go, and there's some really beautiful stuff in that episode that I didn't really expect to happen. I really liked it. I was a fan of the actual show GLOW back in the 80s. I watched it, and I thought it was a nice nostalgic throwback to that, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was really clever and really funny and really sweet. And a terrific ensemble, and I'm looking forward to the second season. Now, I know you liked it.
I definitely liked it. I felt like it basically got better and better and better as it went along. I thought it was fun and enjoyable for the first few episodes, and around the fifth or sixth episode, it really clicked in for me, and the characters all started feeling much more real and much more rooted in something that wasn't just, you know, cheap punchlines. And gradually, bit by bit, a handful of the women in the wrestling troupe got full characterization. Several of them are definitely still waiting for a second season on that. I think there are still four or five whose real names I couldn't tell you who I couldn't tell you a thing about them. Because, you know, it's one of those things that happens if you're only doing 10 episodes and you're only doing 30 to 35 minutes per episode. You know, you're not going to get everybody there. So that's a small quibble. But no, Alison Brie is great, and I think it's a tough character because, they don't care about making her unlikable and then pulling her back. You know, they start her in a place where she does a couple things early on that are tough to stomach and tough to stomach for the characters in the show. And so then they have to work her back into your heart, and they do that, and it helps that she's Alison Brie, because if she weren't, it might be harder.
Right.
But I think they do the wrestling reasonably well. You know, they've gone to a lot of trouble to emphasize that the actresses did their own stunts, and I think that probably limits some of what they were able to do, either because of physicality or insurance purposes. But I thought the wrestling matches themselves were pretty good, and it's just an enjoyable show in 10 episodes, 30 minutes.
It's great. I'm a wrestling fan myself, and I was a little skeptical about the wrestling stuff until the final episode when they actually put on the show, and then I was like, wow, these women are doing some great stuff here. Because within the logic of the show, the Alison Brie character is working really, really hard and has some really great moves and stuff. Everybody else seems to be struggling. But then in the last episode, when they finally do the show, They're all doing terrific ring work, I thought. And I was surprised by that. I was surprised by how good the wrestling was in the final episode.
But the question is that does that mean it was unrealistically good? Did they advance far too quickly?
That's a good question.
I have no answer to that. I don't know how good they're really supposed to be, given that where the show gets is only so far. You know, that it
right.
doesn't get into a year and a half when they've all been doing this
right.
for a while and they're all basically pros. You know,
right.
they're still amateurish.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, no, there's a bit of a jump in logic in terms of not just the wrestling, but you know the extras that they have, you know, who are escorting people out. They bring out a robot at one point, and the costumes are suddenly like really. And so, I mean, the fact that they pulled that show out of what was set up seems unrealistic. But I wasn't quibbling. I guess they did a lot of sewing off screen.
And people really love that robot. There's a whole cult around that robot already online.
Is that right? Really?
People get fixated on things like that very easily. And so the robot in GLOW has become a lot like Barb in Stranger Things. In that the online presence has dramatically outstripped the actual on-screen role that the character played.
I'm gonna have to look that up. I'm definitely gonna have to look that up.
I'm guessing that season two will be heavily about the robot.
Like season two of Stranger Things is going to be about Barb. Is that what the?
No, everyone insists there is no Barb return in Stranger Things season two. I interviewed Sean Levy about it, and he swears they are not going to cheat and bring back Barb, and just as well, because bringing back Barb would have been pandering to the lowest instincts of the fan base, and I would like for Stranger Things to aspire to more than that.
I agree. When does that come back, by the way?
It comes back at Halloween.
Halloween. Oh, good. Okay, cool. And we'll look forward to that. Okay, Dan, hang on. We're going to take a break. We got the news coming up. Then afterwards, I want to talk about the TCA Award nominees, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, great. Dan Feinberg, everybody. We got to take a break here on 720 WGN for the news. When we come back, we will tell you all about this year's nominees for the 2017 Television Critics Association Awards. And that's coming up after the news, which is next. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, overlooking beautiful Michigan Avenue here. And we're here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. That gets your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And we're going to play a little pop-up video later, and we're going to talk about the best mascots of all time. Right now, though, we are smack dab in the middle of our discussion with Dan Feinberg. Joins us every couple of weeks, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Prince, F-I-E-N. And welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
All right. Tell everybody about the TCA Awards and all that stuff. And you are the – what position do you hold? You vice president?
Currently the vice president, so yes. And the TCA Awards are our annual award show. It tends to be a pretty efficient in and out, 12 categories. We usually tend to have the show run about an hour and 20 minutes. We used to be able to do it in an hour, but, you know, people like to make speeches and whatnot. And just our chance to honor the year's best of TV, and we announced our nominees beginning of last week because we wanted to make sure that they would have at least a week to be out there to hopefully inspire Emmy voters to make some good choices as well. And honestly, while I have some definite quibbles with our nominees because, you know, always going to, I think we did a reasonably good job, all things considered, whether
yeah.
or not.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list. I think it's pretty cool. Let's go through the categories. Now, you guys picked individual achievement in categories instead of splitting it up between male and female, correct?
Yes, and instead of splitting it up between supporting and lead. So it's individual achievement in drama. So that is male, female, supporting, lead, TV show, or in this glorious age, movie or miniseries. So yes, individual achievement in drama and individual achievement in comedy. And this year's nominees are heavily balanced, towards the female side of things, which reflects how many great performances there are from actresses of all types on the small screen.
It's true. Individual achievement in drama, Sterling K. Brown, This Is Us, Carrie Coon, The Leftovers and Fargo, Claire Foy for The Crown, Nicole Kidman, Big Little Lies, Jessica Lange, Feud, My Future Ex-Wife, Elizabeth Moss, The Handmaid's Tale, and Susan Sarandon, Feud. That's a tough category right there.
It's pretty remarkable, and those are some pretty great choices. And several of them are going to be going head-to-head in different categories at the Emmys. So, you know, it would be great if Elizabeth Moss and Carrie Coon were going head-to-head at the Emmys, but I'm not sure if they're going to. Certainly, I'm guessing Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon and Nicole Kidman are all going to be going head-to-head at the Emmys. But, it's a tough category, and I'm personally very glad that Carrie Coon got a nomination and got it for both of the two shows.
Yeah.
That I believe is unprecedented in TCA history. They doubled nomination like that, but it was uniquely deserved in this case.
Individual achievement in comedy, Pamela Adlon, Better Things, Aziz Ansari, Master of None, Kristen Bell, The Good Place, Donald Glover, Atlanta, Julie Louis-Dreyfus for Veep, Issa Rae for Insecure, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge for Fleabag, which is a show I've never seen.
And you really should, because you would really enjoy it. That is a promise, and it's only 6 episodes on Amazon. So easy peasy.
Okay, cool.
And the thing I love about this category is the number of multi-hyphenates there are. So between Pamela Adlon, Aziz Ansari, Donald Glover, Issa Rae, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, those are 5 people who write, direct, and star in their shows. I believe they're all creators or co-creators of their shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty remarkable, because the Individual Achievement Awards, they are open to creatives as well. We just never tend to nominate showrunners, which we always could, but it's just never an option anyone thinks of. And I kind of love how many of these people are doing all of this. How many of these people, the whole show just comes out of them. And then, of course, there's Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Kristen Bell, who are just great.
Yeah.
Just great at what they do.
Absolutely. Outstanding Achievement, News and Information, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. The Lead with Jake Tapper, O.J. Made in America, Planet Earth 2, and Wiener. I'm assuming this is just going to go to O.J. Made in America.
I wouldn't assume, because both Last Week Tonight and Full Frontal are former winners in this category, and we've had a recent history of comedy news programs doing very well in this category. For a while, it was seen as a strange thing. There was one year Jon Stewart won, and he sent in a video taking us to task because his show was not actually a news show, et cetera. But yeah, this is the only nomination for OJ, and if I had to tell you the thing that annoys me the most about these nominations of ours, only one nomination for OJ Made in America ticks me off a little. So if it's only going to have one nomination, I hope it wins, but that's only my one vote.
Okay. Let's see. Outstanding Achievement in Reality Programming, The Circus, The Great British Baking Show. Boy, that show, I'm telling you, people love that show, man.
They really do.
Yeah, The Keepers, Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath, Shark Tank, and Survivor, Game Changers. So that's your reality programming?
Kind of all over the map.
And I
don't know that I could guess how people are going to go. Because as you say, people love The Great British Baking Show. People who have watched The Keepers love The Keepers. I don't know how many people have watched it.
Mm-hmm.
So. And people really dig that Leah Remini show. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Outstanding Achievement in Youth Programming, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, Doc McStuffins, Elena of Avalor, Odd Squad, Sesame Street, and Speechless. Okay.
It's a tough category, because we've both given it to shows that are very clearly directed at the youngest of viewers. So if you look at those nominees, 5 of them fit into that category. But we've also traditionally also given it to shows like Switched at Birth or The Fosters, which are about kind of family, non-traditional family dynamics.
Right.
And that clearly is where Speechless fits
right,
in. So
right.
these are 2 very different instincts of the TCA votership, and it will be interesting to see which one reigns supreme.
Okay. This is a tough category, I think. Outstanding New Program, Atlanta, The Crown, The Good Place, Handmaid's Tale, Stranger Things, and This Is Us. That's a tough category. Another one.
Those are all just good shows. There's nothing I can say about that. And those are probably among the best new shows of the year. Whether I would, you know, add or subtract something, it's a good group of nominees. Mm-hmm. I like that group.
Yep. Best achievement in movies, miniseries, and specials: Big Little Lies, Fargo, Feud, Betty and Joan, Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life, The Night Of, and Wizard of Lies. So,
also a tough field. You know, you look at the nominations, and it certainly looks like Big Little Lies has a lot of support across the categories, but obviously both Feud leading ladies were nominated. Mm-hmm. So I feel reasonably confident that Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life is not going to win.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Outstanding achievement in drama: Better Call Saul, Stranger Things, The Americans, The Crown, The Handmaid's Tale, and This Is Us. These are really, man, I'm telling you, there's a lot of good TV, man.
There is, and for the most part, we did recognize the right things. So that's a good group of shows. Whether I would swap in a couple things here or there, and am I perplexed that The Leftovers has a nomination a little bit later in a bigger category, but not here? And would I put The Leftovers in this category over most of those shows? Yes. Mm-hmm. But those are six good shows.
Right. Outstanding achievement in comedy: Atlanta, Blackish, Fleabag, Master of None, The Good Place, and Veep. And Blackish won last year, right? Yeah.
Yes, it did. And just a good show, but you need to watch Fleabag. That's what
okay.
I'm saying.
Okay.
You know, you've got a holiday weekend coming up, and it's only six episodes. And trust me, you're not going to want to watch this week's new Netflix show, Gypsy. You can just skip right over that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And then Program of the Year: Atlanta, Big Little Lies, Stranger Things, The Handmaid's Tale, The Leftovers, and This Is Us. So there's your Leftovers category right there.
Which, it's confusing because, you know, you never know. Award voters do strange things, and you know, sometimes people don't want to write down the same show five times, and so they're like, I'm going to vote for Leftovers in the big category, but maybe not in the other one, and that's how it ends up being here. But those are some good choices. I think that if we'd voted in March, This Is Us would have won, but who knows now? And frankly, OJ Made in America should be in that group.
Yeah,
and I'm ticked off, but I nominated OJ for absolutely everything across the board: individual achievement in comedy, you know, everything. So
right.
Whatever.
Yeah, and so when is the award ceremony? It's the 5th of August.
It is the 5th of August, down the road. Kristen Chenoweth is our host, and you know, it should be a. Should be a fun time, and I will report back afterwards and let you know all of the highs and lows. But looking at the categories and looking at the nominees, there's very little room for big mistakes. You know, sometimes we do stupid things, and we give, you know, Heroes Program of the Year, and a year or two later we look back and we go, oh, that was clearly an oopsie. But I don't feel as if there's that kind of thing here. Of course, you know, maybe season two of Handmaid's Tale will be horrible, or maybe a lot of these are first year shows, so maybe season two of Atlanta will be horrible, or maybe, you know, who knows, any one of these shows could go south. But looking at it right now, regardless of what wins almost any of these categories, I think it's gonna be a pretty deserving show/person.
Yeah. All right, great. We're looking forward to it. And before we let you go, when does Game of Thrones premiere? It premieres in like 3 weeks, right?
It premieres on July 16th. So I wrote a column today in the Hollywood Reporter basically saying this is the closest to a lull you're going to get in your TV schedule probably all year. And so now's the time to catch up on everything. In your case, that means it's time to catch up on Leftovers and to watch Fleabag. In my case, it means so many damn things.
Have you gone back to Kimmy Schmidt yet?
No, it's on my list.
Okay.
It's on my list. Maybe this weekend I'll watch a few episodes, and maybe I'll watch the 8 episodes I haven't watched of Dear White People and so much stuff.
Yeah.
Unreal.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, Dan. Thanks for hanging out with us. You can check out Dan at The Hollywood Reporter and follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. All right, Dan, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, okay?
Always a pleasure.
Okay, buddy, take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Love talking TV with Dan, and we'll do it again in a couple of weeks. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to, in honor of JoJo, the new fantastic mascot for Jewel Osco, we're going to talk about mascots for other products and companies and the best and the weirdest and the worst. 312-981-7200 is the phone number.